Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Academic success. Are teenagers paying too high a price? I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Silicon Valley's Palo Alto School District is in crisis. The suicide rate for teenagers there is 4 to 5 times the national average. This tragic statistic has made the city a symbol of the pressure kids live under in affluent communities to get into elite colleges and to excel at everything. This week, as high school seniors and their families rush to finish their college applications, we ask whether the obsession with getting into the best colleges is hurting kids more than helping them, and what schools, parents, and students can do to lessen the stress. Also in today's Talking Point, a landmark agreement on the comfort women of World War II. First news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, as college application deadlines loom, parents, educators, and mental health professionals are asking if the amped-up pressure on kids to get into elite schools has pushed students to the breaking point. That's coming up on the main part of our program today. And later on our Talking Point, more than 70 years after the end of World War II, Japan and South Korea have finally resolved their dispute over what to do about the Korean women who were forced to serve in military brothels for the Imperial Army, the long-awaited settlement for the comfort women. That's later on the show. First, this news update. Iraqi government forces retook central parts of the key city of Ramadi today from the Islamic State, although pockets of resistance remain. Recovering control over Ramadi would allow Iraq to cut off supply lines to Fallujah and potentially retake that city as well. Matt Bradley is Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and joins us from Baghdad. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what is the status of the fighting in Ramadi right now? How secure is the hold of the Iraqi forces on the city?
Not particularly secure. We're talking about essentially most of the city is now under government control, really about 50% of it. Another about maybe 25% of it is disputed, and then there's about 20% of it, this is our understanding, that's under fully Islamic State control. The Iraqi government has said repeatedly that once they were able to raise their national flag over the government compound in the center of the city, that's the metric by which they will judge whether or not the city has been liberated. So they're essentially saying, yes, we still have some clearing operations to do, but we've been able to raise our flag in the center of the city, so we're declaring it liberated now.
Now, you've been writing about the new role of Sunni forces in this particular surge, and it's a complicated political landscape. So how decisive was the Sunni forces' role in the battle over Ramadi so far?
This was more of a symbolic or a political gesture to try to sort of show a sectarian unified front against Islamic State. We're going to see probably in the coming weeks whether or not the Sunni force that was raised by the United States, trained to hold territory, not necessarily to attack territory, but to hold it, whether they will actually be able to do what they've been trained to do. Right now, all we've been able to see is that they've taken kind of a support role in a mission that was led both by the Iraqi special forces, the counterterrorism forces, and regular Iraqi army with support by the U.S. from the air. So that hasn't been such a decisive factor in the battle itself, but it will be in the politics that follow.
Well, if Iraq can reestablish control over the city, then how significant a victory over ISIS is this? Is this a turning point in the conflict?
Well, it's a turning point among other turning points. This is the third major defeat that Islamic State has sustained in as many months. So they were routed in the oil refinery city of Beji in October by Shiite militia groups with backing from the U.S. and from some Iraqi military forces. Kurdish militants were able to oust them from the city of Sinjar last month. So this is something of a turning point. We're in the midst of seeing what looks like Islamic State now on the back foot, and they're in something of a retreat, at least in Iraq. We're also seeing, of course, at the same time, that Kurdish fighters are moving against Islamic State positions at a dam in northern Syria as we speak. So the tide is turning for Islamic State, but it could go either way. This doesn't necessarily have to be a decisive turn against Islamic State. It depends on the actors involved.
And in terms of Fallujah and Mosul at this point, how entrenched is ISIS? Are they significantly less vulnerable than Ramadi was?
They've held ISIS, they've held Fallujah for the past 2 years. So Fallujah is the city that they've held longer than any other city in Iraq, even longer than Mosul. Mosul is a large city that has quite a bit of indigenous support for Islamic State, even though there are quite a few, the majority of the people, in my understanding, are suffering under Islamic State domination. Mosul will be a big, big challenge. It's by far the largest city that Islamic State holds in either Iraq or Syria. And moving against it, with a majority Shia Iraqi military, will be politically complicated, and it could get some people who are within Mosul to support or at least just harbor or sustain the presence of Islamic State if they felt that, if they feel that the military coming from Baghdad is more of an occupying force than anything else.
And how should we understand the importance of the coalition airstrikes and the effectiveness of U.S. foreign policy against the Islamic State in light of this victory or the supposed alleged victory right now in Ramadi?
Yeah. To talk to American generals, American commanders, you'll hear that the coalition airstrikes were decisive. But that wasn't the only thing, of course. The U.S. was also training the Iraqi military, or rather retraining the Iraqi military and resupplying the Iraqi military. And that was a decisive change for this battle. So the United States has had a major, major role. And so when we talk about whether Ramadi was vindicating the actual Iraqi military, it was also vindicating the United States' support for the Iraqi military and for Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, who has come under such withering criticism from hardline Shias within his government and among these Shiite militia groups for supporting and from being seen as too close to the United States.
And as you are pointing out, the prevailing wisdom is that without the Sunni support for Iraq's Shia government, the state is too weak to fend off ISIS in the long run. So what would ensure a greater Sunni Arab representation in Iraqi government? And is that reflected in any way by U.S. foreign policy?
It's something that the United States is trying to do diplomatically, but it's very, very tough. There's a lot of lingering resentment among many in Shiite, mostly hardline Shiite quarters in the Iraqi government.
And I am so sorry to ask you the hardest question at the very end. Thank you so much, Matt Bradley.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, based in Baghdad.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
And this is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave and for Warren Olney. This week leading up to New Year's, it's a pretty relaxing time, isn't it? I imagine many of you are on vacation, you're surrounded by friends and family. Everyone is not on holiday, though. For millions of high school seniors and their parents across the nation, this week is crunch time. Most college applications are due January 1st or in the very first weeks of the new year. So for them, tensions are running high, so high that many educators, parents, mental health professionals, and students are questioning whether the pressure that kids feel to get into college is out of all proportion, and whether it's leading to anxiety disorders, emotional problems, and in some tragic cases, suicide. One city in particular is suffering on that score. Palo Alto, in the heart of Silicon Valley. The suicide rate for teenagers there is 4 to 5 times the national average. Julie Lithcott-Hames joins us now. She's a former dean of freshmen at Stanford University. She's also a mother of a 14 and a 16-year-old in Palo Alto. And she's the author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kid for Success. I'm very glad to have you on the show.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Well, first to these just heartbreaking suicide clusters over the past 10 years in Palo Alto. For those of us who didn't read a recent Atlantic Magazine story about this, could you please fill us in? How many students died and what was the time frame?
Sure. So you're referring to Hannah Rosen's article in The Atlantic, and in which she detailed the nature of the difficulties we've been having here. The first suicide cluster, as it's called, happened in 2009 and 10, where I believe it was six students took their lives. And then again last fall in 2014 into 2015, there were five students in our community who took their lives. And they didn't all live in Palo Alto. Most of them did. And so that's a summary of our situation.
Well, there are never straightforward answers to why people commit suicide. But are there significant similarities between these students, the circumstances who took their lives, that explain why the rate might be so high in Palo Alto?
Well, I'm not a suicidologist, let me say that. I've certainly read lots of the commentary and perspectives that have come out surrounding what's been happening in Palo Alto. Here's what I know. Initially, the community's conclusion was that the students who were taking their lives were very depressed, were involved in counseling for significant mental health problems. And in that sense, we were able to say, well, it's the very troubled kids. But then last fall, there was a young man who took his life who was just kind of everybody's friend. Everybody knew him. Everybody loved him. He was smart and hardworking and engaged and athletic and thoughtful and kind. And when he took his life, his name was Cameron, every one of us said, wait a minute. We could no longer say it's only, quote-unquote, those kids on the margins, those kids who are suffering from extreme mental health difficulties. Cameron's death was a wake-up call for every single parent. Every one of us said, if Cameron might take his life, then who's to say my kid isn't going to feel that life isn't worth living? Cameron's death shone a light on the situation that I think made it impossible for us to ignore what was going on.
Well, part of the premise of the Atlantic story is that Palo Alto's public high schools are like those in a lot of affluent communities, right? Like New York City and Washington, D.C. and Greenwich, Connecticut, and here in Los Angeles, only more so. In fact, it called it an extreme distillation of what parents and these elite expect from a school. Is that going too far? And could you, in your mind, do you connect up the dots between what's happening in your community and a general feeling of overwhelming pressure on kids to succeed and to get into elite schools?
Absolutely. Look, this is why I wrote my book, How to Raise an Adult. I was seeing that so many kids were under such tremendous pressure to achieve at, in an academic sense, to have the right GPA, to have the right grades in order to get into the quote-unquote right colleges. And as a freshman dean, what I was seeing was, hey, even if a student has those top grades and scores, they can end up being an 18-year-old, a 20-year-old, a 22-year-old who's not terribly familiar with their own selves as a person because their life has been lived in pursuit of getting a certain set of grades and scores. And I wanted to ask the question, you know, is that what makes a whole healthy human? I think in communities like mine in Palo Alto and those others that you've named and plenty more, we parents and as a community more broadly, we've gotten fixated on a small set of colleges we think are the only right ones worth attending. And those colleges seem to demand a level of perfection of our kids in order to be admitted. And so we set them on that course with the best of intentions toward the possibility of that college admission. And, you know, most kids, I think, can't handle the pressure and stress that it takes to, you know, achieve these GPAs well over 4.0 or these SAT scores that are at or near 2400. So I think our definition, our very definition of what is success and what does what is the role of college in leading to a successful life, I think those are the questions that have to be interrogated. I think if we can broaden those definitions and help our, you know, our adolescents and teenagers see there's a broad range of colleges you can go to. Most of them are not cutthroat competitive. You know, you can go to a great college even with an imperfect record in adolescence, and you will be a successful person who can lead a happy life. If we can believe that and start to help our kids really understand that, I think we'd be doing all of our kids a great service.
Well, turning to our next guest, Sunya Luther is a professor of psychology at Arizona State University and professor emeritus at Columbia University's Teachers College. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, so far we've been talking about pretty affluent kids, and you've studied teenagers at both ends, at all ends of the economic spectrum. What does the data tell us about the mental health of teenagers in general and whether academic pressure affects them equally?
We have data, you're right, from children at both ends of the SES socioeconomic spectrum. And we do find an overrepresentation, disproportionate number of youngsters with mental health difficulties at each end. But obviously the reasons are different. What we find, symptoms in inner city settings and poverty, the stressors obviously are related much more to poverty itself, gang violence, lack of safety, and so on. And when you jump across the middle class and so on, get to the top 5-10% of society, that's where you start seeing it's certainly not about physical safety, but around these issues of pressure, success, who am I, what am I going to amount to, and what will happen to me if I don't succeed.
And what's happening in the middle there? Because you said the top 5%.
This is what's fascinating. People often ask me, doesn't everybody suffer from the same pressures? And I say, yes, I suppose to some degree they do. But the difference is when you're talking about the top 5-10%, these goals are well within reach. These are children of parents who themselves have attended some of the most prestigious schools, have the legacy issue going, have the opportunity, the means with which to buy their children the SAT tutors or the sports coaches or music coaches. So the bottom line is that for the upper 10% or so, as I say in this article I just wrote, we can, therefore we must. We can afford it, so we do it. The middle class is not quite as fortunate in terms of being able to buy these things, so it's not something they aspire to necessarily to the degree we do. In our case, it's essential. We must. We have to.
So you describe it as an unhealthy perfectionism, this pressure to succeed at all costs because we can, because we have this within our means. But there, you also bring up an interesting issue. A cause of distress is that affluent kids feel isolated from their parents. So how can this be with all of this helicopter parenting going on?
Speaking as a parent myself, and those of you that are mothers, as I know at least one of you is, you can be around your child pretty much through the day and really not connect with your child, unfortunately, at a level that he or she wants you to. In our work, we've been doing this research for now close to 2 decades, and the theme that comes up more and more is, I wish my mom would get out of my face, or I wish my dad would just listen. So it's very possible, and you know the parents are around, they're attending the games, they're driving the kids to and from the tutoring and the rehearsals and the practices, but when the child says, there's a very moving part of Hannah Rosen's article where this young girl said that she really was so exhausted and wanted so much to tell her parents, who were around all the time, they ate together and all the rest of it, ate dinner every night, she wanted so much to convey to them how completely exhausted she was, but was not able to get that across.
You know, you've talked to so many teenagers in your surveys and your research, and I find it really interesting that parents, when they get together, they say, well, I try not to put pressure on my kids. They're putting it on themselves. And you asked kids what their values were, and you found that many had, I guess, internalized their parents. It didn't take their parents having to say it. They had internalized their parents, the goals and wishes and dreams for them, their values.
I'm very glad you brought that up. Well, first thing I want to say in response to that question, it's not all about parents. The one thing I struggle with is our tendency to sort of demonize the parents because they're an easy target. If the parents only backed off, the kids would be fine. Well, of course, that's partly true. in the upper middle classes as everywhere else. If a parent's too pushy or unkind or whatever, the child's going to hurt. But this pressure does not come only for the from the parents. We need to be very clear about that. If you tell a child, drop the AP class, don't try and be a starter on the third sports team for the year, the child is going to come back to you more likely than not and say, Mom, what are you talking about? You tell the child, you don't have to take the SAT a third time. Everybody does it is the refrain that comes back from many of these kids. And the truth is, many of the kids do it. So that the pressure that when people say, where is this pressure coming from? Probably the more appropriate question is, where is the pressure not coming from? It comes from their peers, comes from their schools, it comes from society, it comes from the universities. Where is it not coming from?
And because we started the hour talking about teenagers and suicide, from your research, have you found that wealthier teenagers are more likely to kill themselves or attempt it?
Well, what I can tell you is that wealthier teenagers are between 2.5 to 3 times more likely to report problems at serious levels of symptoms, whether they're of depression or anxiety or of self-harm. They're 2.5 to 3 times as likely. Then there's a whole other cluster, which is rule breaking and substance use. On this cluster as well, we find that our children are doing much more than the average American child.
And going back to Julie Lithcott-Hames, former dean of freshmen at Stanford University, was that your experience with students at Stanford? Is that what they would talk to you about when they came to you with problems, that maybe their relationship with their parents was out of whack? They feel distant from their parents? Or do they just feel that generalized, overwhelming anxiety and pressure?
The first thing that I want to say to Sunia's point is I agree we should not be demonizing parents. And I do not demonize parents. I do write about the role we parents play or can play and should play in the face of this pressure that is coming from peers and from schools and from community. You know, when I think about the kids in my community who have taken their lives, you know, I'm not saying their parents, you know, put that pressure on them, but I am asking, what can we parents do to wrestle back some sense of normalcy in childhood when our communities seem to have childhood on, you know, level 10, and, you know, it's putting an incredible amount of pressure on our kids. I think it's not enough to say it's the system and to throw up our hands and say, you know, what can we do? I think as parents, we can do a lot to try to counteract the pressures and to redefine what success is and to help our kids feel valued as humans because they exist, not because of their GPA. To your question about, you know, what did I see at Stanford, I saw students who were quite dependent upon parents for advice and guidance. Parents were very involved in decision making and in problem solving for the undergraduates I worked with. They were close in a way that perhaps you and I weren't when we were teens with respect to our own parents.
But dependent in a way that made the teenagers feel like they couldn't really do it for themselves?
Well, yes. I mean, the term that I've come up with is they seemed, those that I was concerned about, by no means all of my students, but those that I was concerned about seemed to me to be existentially impotent. They didn't seem familiar with their own selves. They'd been quite good at doing as they were told and excelling within a system that was asking them to, you know, achieve more and more and more. But had they made a volitional choice and had they had a chance to fail and pick themselves up, you know, had they had a chance to kind of lay the path of their own life, or were they just incredibly, incredibly good at doing as was expected of them?
Julie Lithcott-Hames, former dean of freshmen at Stanford University. And after the break, we're going to continue this conversation about college applications and how the ever-increasing pressure to succeed academically is affecting teenagers' health. And later on our talking point, a final agreement on what to do about the comfort women of Korea during World War II. Stay with us for that. That's next on To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
The This is To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the alarming rate of depression, anxiety, and in isolated cases, suicide among teenagers in the U.S., whether excessive pressure to get into elite colleges is driving this, and what can be done to lessen the stress. Gwaith Smith Jr. is a former college guidance counselor for high schools, primarily on Long Island, and now he helps guide families through the college application process nationwide, and he joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Barbara.
Well, how do you see the excessive pressure cooker mentality playing itself out in the college application process? And full disclosure, I've gone through this twice. I have two children in college right now, so I'm preaching to the choir.
I think it is. It has taken on a life of its own, unfortunately. I think in many ways we have, and it's not just parents, it is schools, it is peers, it is the pressure that is in many cases you might qualify as saying self-imposed, because it's a way of life, and it's wrong. I have no question with that. I have spoken at many schools across the country, and I frankly should not have a private practice doing this. There is work to be done. There's life to be lived. And normally I will sit with families, and one of my opening questions is to the parent, where did you go to school? And I will do that in the context of, that is there going to be a legacy? But the bigger message is, whoa, you've done quite well having gone to this particular school, because usually the expectations for their children are much, much higher and sometimes unrealistic. What I've attempted to do over time, and we started a course at my last high school where I retired from with the AP English teacher called Essay Writing for College. And it really was an attempt, and I think it has worked incredibly well, where the student is asked to reflect on self. Who am I? What are my aspirations? What do I want people to know about me that is going to be beyond the numbers? And I think it has been a process for young people that they frankly have embraced, because we haven't given that forum to most of our students going through psychologically, some difficult times.
Well, what's really going on, though? Because we're talking about a lot of anecdotal evidence, and I'm thinking that well-off families, they've always put pressure on their kids to achieve mm-hmm. and to go to the best schools. Is it somehow worse now? Is it worse because it's harder to get into these schools than it was just even 5-7 years ago?
Oh, I think that certainly plays into it. You know, when you look at your Stanfords and the Ivy groups and those most selective colleges that are accepting under 10% of their applicant pool, there are things that students no longer controlled that I think we controlled as we went through the process back in the day. And I think that has made it very, very difficult, because one of the other things I say to young people, don't personalize the decision. It is not, many times, it's not about you. There are going to be institutional needs. There are going to be the geographic piece. There are going to be all kinds of factors that come into, I think, these selective schools looking to create the world on their campus to bring differences together, where we learn to live, to debate, to talk with one another over that 4 or 5 year period of time during their undergraduate years, where perhaps we get a better understanding of who we are and where we are, not only as a country, but as a world.
Well, I want to move on and talk to our student, but just one more question for you. You said earlier you shouldn't be doing the job that you're doing. Are you in this weird position of talking to parents and saying, look, don't hire the tutors. Don't hire somebody like me. Don't play into this. Isn't that what we should do?
I'm in that position, and it sounds rather deleterious, but it does, unfortunately, when you look at it, if their people, including the students, are going to play with this, then they need to level the playing field, but with some reason. I work with a lot of data. I keep my spreadsheets over the years in terms of the acceptances or deferrals or rejections from colleges, and we'll use data to say, this is some of the things that you need to do. Here are the things that you need to understand. Because at the end of the day, I don't want a youngster devastated thinking, well, nobody said this, might not work.
Well, let's talk now to the person on whom the pressure is bearing. Carolyn Walworth is a senior at Palo Alto High School in Palo Alto, where in the last 10 years, the suicide rate among high school students has been 4 to 5 times higher than the rest of the nation. She's one of the high school's school board representatives, and I want to thank you for taking the time during the holidays to join us, Carolyn.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you wrote an op-ed for Palo Alto Online about what's been going on in your school, and you said in it that for you the stress began even back in elementary school. So how did you feel back then?
So definitely in elementary school, the pressure wasn't necessarily on getting a good SAT score, getting perfect grades, but you definitely saw a difference where students started to realize, I'm more academically competent than another student because my reading abilities are better, and we had separate classes for the students who were more advanced at English or less advanced at English. And so you kind of get a sense of, the student's better than me, or I'm, in a sense, dumber than this other student. So that's definitely where I feel like it starts, the social pressure starts. And then throughout middle school, you start to get kind of stressed out because you feel the upcoming sense of stress because of preparing for colleges and wanting to get into a good school and just the stress of high school. And then in high school, obviously, like the main stress starts where you see, now I actually have to start studying to get these good grades and good SAT scores and things like that.
And how did the stress that you're talking about affect you? Like, how did you feel it? You get stomach aches, headaches? How does it come out?
Definitely for me, it manifested itself through lots of anxiety, and that was physical anxiety, which at some points did send me to like urgent care because I was freaked out, like because the pain was so intense. But a lot of the time it was just stress and crying and me feeling kind of hopeless and like I couldn't really do anything to get out of the situation.
That's so awful. Well, what about your parents? Where were they through this?
My parents have always been incredibly supportive of me academically. They've never really put any stress on me academically. If anything, they've discouraged me from taking as big of a load of hard classes as I have.
And so they were giving you a different message.
Definitely.
But it didn't register?
Despite my parents wanted me to go to a good school, and I shared that idea, but they were never pressuring me to say, you need to go to Stanford or you need to go to an Ivy League school. They just wanted me to kind of focus on learning for the sake of learning, and that was a message that I didn't really register until my upperclassman years at Pali.
So that message got drowned out by what? By the pressure that you felt all around you? Is it that kind of free-floating anxiety that you pick up from your friends?
Yeah, I would say that I felt the pressure to try to get into an Ivy League-type school due to the social atmosphere at the school, because you see everybody kind of being hyper-competitive, everybody saying that, they have these internships with, some incredible professor at Stanford or something like that. You see everyone doing all these amazing things, and you really feel the need to be a part of that, and you feel the need to be included and feel smart. And if you don't do that, you're kind of less of a person or less worthy or less cool socially.
And what about the workload? Was that contributing to it, a major factor? Because I think I read somewhere that you said you had 4 hours of homework a night, and that might be pretty much on average throughout the nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely that's around how many hours I get. Still in my senior year of high school, I still get around that much. And definitely having that much to do on top of extracurriculars and just socializing and just dealing with growing up and being a teenager adds up to a lot, and it makes me really frustrated because it's not enough free time to really grow as a person.
Well, I want to turn to Sunya Luthar. I want to come back to you and see what you would like to do differently if you had your high school time to do over again. But first, let's hear what Sunya Luthar has to say. She's a professor of psychology at Arizona State University. So what can parents do to ease the pressure off kids? We just heard Carolyn say, look, her parents, they really didn't put the pressure on, but it didn't matter.
Yeah, and I think Julie's absolutely right. Starting with parents is a very good place to start, and we're actually doing the same sort of thing on our end. I guess parents, we And I, like you, I have two grown children, 25 and almost 22, so I've lived this. Are really going to have to bend over backwards to help our children understand. As has been said before, you are way, way, way more than your accomplishments. Do not define yourself that. That's not how I see you. I see you for the human being you are, and I love and value you for the human being you are. And you will get an education. So it's almost like you don't say this once, you say it 20 times in every way, shape, or form. And no, say it sincerely, because if you don't believe it, your children are going to see it. And the next step is work with the school, and we're doing that as well. I think what we just heard was absolutely correct. It's not just the parents, it's the teachers, it's the peers. They talk to each other. So what did you get? Are you in a DAP class? Are you a starter? They talk to each other. So we are going to have to work to change the school culture and how these young people talk to each other and relate to each other every bit as much.
Well, saying stuff is one thing, but modeling sane behavior is another. And starting with grade school, I certainly seen parents who do their kids' homework. They write their kids' papers. It doesn't just start with the college application process, this kind of doing everything for their child to get them ahead. Do parents have to let their kids fail? And how do you instill that into the culture?
Yes, parents are terrified that the children are going to fall behind. And again, as everybody's been saying, this starts very, very young. And back to Julie's point, yes, we do need to let our children fail, whether it's not making the advanced reading group in the second grade or further up, not getting the third chance at the SAT. Yes, it's a very hard thing for parents to do because we do want the best for our children. All of us do.
Carol. So it's very hard. Carolyn Walworth, speaking as the one teenager in this conversation, what would have made your life easier leading up to college?
I think definitely having less of a homework load or having classes that were structured in such a way that, you know, not as much homework was required, or we did more of it in class, or somehow the teachers were more effective in their teaching methods. I think that would have been the main thing that would have improved my situation.
What about what we're talking about, how parents create this situation where they're helping other kids so much that the playing field is not even for the ones who don't get that kind of helicoptering?
I agree that that's definitely a problem. I don't really know quite how much I can speak to that, but it definitely does create an unfair advantage.
Julie Lithgow-Hames, the former dean of freshmen at Stanford University, let's get your perspective on this. Do you have conversations with administrators or with your kids about what the workload should be, what homework should be, what a sane amount of homework to do is, whether it's okay to back off of the 15 extracurriculars that you're doing to impress colleges?
Well, I work really hard with my two teenagers who go to the school down the rival school to Carolyn's. Carolyn's at Pally. My kids are at Gunn. Carolyn, I admire the work you do in our community as a student member of the school board, the op-ed you've written. And here I've got my own two teens. And in my house, you know, I'm just constantly trying to depressurize the environment, value them as humans, tell them that it's time to go to sleep. I don't care how much more homework they have. Their sleep matters almost more than anything else. I mean, kids in our community aren't sleeping enough. We seem to think they can defer that until they're 20s, as long as they get the right GPA. But our pediatricians are screaming at us that our kids, if they're not sleeping enough, they can't make good judgments. They're not mentally well if they're not sleeping. So as a parent, you know, we have to try to, you know, to be that person who stands up to the crazy, who says, you know, this is too much homework, or maybe you need to step down into a different class because this is just asking too much of you. But I think bigger picture to what Carolyn said so beautifully, she said, you know, to be, you feel like less of a person, you feel less worthy, you feel less socially cool, you know, if you're not doing all of these amazingly high academically achieving things. She talked about going to a good school. And if in our community in Palo Alto and every other community that's struggling with this, if we parents and administrators and teachers could start not equating good school with brand name, if we could start celebrating the fact that people we respect and admire didn't go to the big brand name schools. They went to state schools. They went to small colleges no one has heard of. They went to community college. They didn't go to college. And yet these people are still amazingly successful and happy. If we could put posters of those people up in our high schools and help kids really begin to believe you do not have to go to one of those schools that's denying 90 to 95% of all applicants in order to be worth something in life, if we could start believing that as parents and really preaching that to our kids, I think we could start to turn the tide.
And turning back to college application consultant Gwaith Smith Jr., how hard a battle is that? How uphill a battle is that?
It's a difficult battle, but I will say this. I became the director up in Westchester County a number of years ago that had, in my second year, a graduating class of just over 90 students. I found that they had been in the same classes all throughout school from K through 11 and into 12 because we were small. I found they stopped talking to one another, and I brought the top 12 or so students into my office early in the fall and said, the game is over. I'm about to resign if we cannot change what's transpiring now. And the long story short, kids started talking to one another that afternoon about where they had applied, what they were looking for, et cetera, and had to reestablish in many ways the relationships that they had had since kindergarten. In my last school, when we developed the course, it was extremely important for our youngsters to support one another. So we celebrated those who got admitted, and we also consoled and were there as a group and as a class for those who were not as fortunate. And it gave that family back to one another, where they didn't, and I think in many ways, didn't see it as a failure of self, but that it was part of life. And I think we need in schools to help create that kind of environment instead of the stab in the back kind of thing that says, we're not going to tell you what I'm doing.
And speaking just very practically to the parents who are sitting around the computers with their kids trying to get these applications mm-hmm. done, what could they change about the process to alleviate the stress a bit on their kids and on themselves?
Yeah. Yeah, and at times I had been known to say to parents, either you do this or I do this. And I think I'm better at it than you are. It is the child's voice. It is the child's life. And you need to trust. And I was fairly successful working in schools to help parents back off and become a parent again rather than an advisor. And I see those at times being conflicting roles. And so I ask parents, take a deep breath, have some faith and trust in those where your children are, and we will do the job, and we will help them as they go through this. It's a journey. It doesn't happen overnight. It's a life journey.
Well, Carolyn Walworth, you just got some news. You applied early to college, so tell us where you're going and maybe whether you have anything you'd like to say to the parents out there that they could do better helping their kids.
Yeah, so I applied early to the DeReed College in Portland, Oregon, and I got in, so I'm very excited to be going there. And the main thing that influenced my decision to apply there was because I really would like to focus on learning for the sake of learning and not to obtain some, like, perfect GPA. And, yeah, DeReed has a huge de-emphasis on grades, so that's the main thing that attracted me to the school. And I guess I would say to all the parents out there, just be supportive of your kids and don't pressure them too much. And I would say the most important thing, like Julie was mentioning earlier, there are so many great schools that aren't considered like top elite colleges that you can get into, and you can have such a great life even if you go to one of those schools.
Palo Alto High School senior Carolyn Walworth, headed to Reed. Thank you so much for taking part. And thanks to all of the rest of you. Sunya Luther, professor of psychology at Arizona State University, college application consultant Gwaith Smith Jr., and Julie Lithcott-Hames. She's former dean at Stanford University. I appreciate you taking the time over the holidays to join us on To the Point. Just ahead, 70 years later, finally an apology and a settlement for the women forced to work in brothels for the Japanese Imperial Army during World War II. Some resolution for the comfort women. That's after the break. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
You're listening to The Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. After decades of tension, Japan and South Korea have finally agreed on a landmark settlement concerning one of the darker chapters of World War II, the so-called comfort women, Korean women who were forced to serve as sex slaves for the Japanese Imperial Army. As part of the settlement, Japan formally apologized to South Korea for the use of the comfort women and agreed to pay more than $8 million in compensation. Victor Cha is director of Asian Studies at Georgetown University and senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Good of you to come on the show.
My pleasure, Barbara.
So this has been a source of contention for just over two decades now between South Korea and Japan. Could you remind us of the history between these two countries on the issue? Why has it taken so long for them to come to an agreement on the comfort women?
Well, the issue itself goes back, you know, seven or eight decades. During the Japanese occupation of Korea, independent historians confirm that as many as 200,000 women and girls from Korea, from China, from the Philippines, from other Southeast Asian nations were coerced by the Japanese Imperial Army to work as sex slaves during World War II. And the Japanese government, despite efforts by Koreans and other groups to get them to admit responsibility for this, were not willing to do that. Successive Japanese governments, there was an agreement reached in the 1990s, something called the Murayama Statement, named after former Prime Minister Murayama, and the Kono Statement, which essentially amounted to an admittance and apology. What was difficult this time was that the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, intimated early on in his prime ministership that he might revisit this apology, and that led to a great deal of controversy between the two countries, making it very difficult for Japan and Korea to carry on regular relations for the past 3 years because of concerns that there wasn't going to be a full apology by the current Japanese government for this practice. So in that sense, today's agreement was, I think, a surprise for most, but a pleasant surprise, I think.
Well, how did these two countries reach a deal, and why now, given those disparate views on history?
I think there are a couple of reasons. The first is the political will on both sides. I think for the South Korean government, they really wanted to see some sort of resolution of this issue. You know, there are only about 46 survivors left in Korea. And if this were to wait till the next administration, who knows how many of those would still be alive. So I think there was a personal commitment there. I think on the Japanese side, the Japanese prime minister has already made some very forward-leaning statements about the Pacific War in the U.S. Congress when he was here for a visit last spring, as well as in the Australian Parliament. And this was, I think, the next step in terms of dealing with this very thorny issue between close neighbors, in this case, Korea. I think there was also an economic and strategic angle to this. Economically, bilateral trade, investment, and tourism between Japan and Korea really gone down because of the difficult relationship over this particular issue under the governments of Prime Minister Abe and President Park. And then the bigger strategic reason, I think, is that the situation in North Korea is not getting any better. The U.S., Japan, and South Korea as military allies have not been able to cooperate and coordinate as much as they would like because of this the difficulties over this issue. And, of course, China's activities have also led to a great deal of concern in the region about their intentions, and the inability for the three key allies in Asia to cooperate has been something that's been a concern not just for the United States, but also for the South Koreans and the Japanese.
Well, getting to the specifics of this, Japan is giving $8.3 million in compensation. What's that money for, and what exactly is going to happen with it? As you point out, there are only about 46 surviving
46.
Comfort women.
Yeah. So this money is going to be given directly by the Japanese government to a fund that the South Korean government will administer to comfort women survivors. And so that's significant for two reasons. The first is that in 1995, there was an Asian Women's Fund that was created, a private fund that was created for the benefit of comfort women survivors throughout Asia. But the concern about that was that it was private. It wasn't something that the Japanese government directly funded, which then meant the Japanese government were not admitting that they were responsible. So What's different this time is that this is something funded directly by the Japanese government. The amount of money does not seem large for a country like Japan. It amounts to 1 billion yen, or as you said, 8.6 million U.S. dollars. But the amount of money isn't really the issue. It was the fact that the Japanese government was directly funding it, and that in the agreement that the government admitted responsibility for these women being used by the Japanese army during war.
And how are the surviving comfort women reacting to the news of the settlement?
We'll have to see. There have already been some NGO groups and some of the survivors that have come out opposed to the agreement.
They called it a diplomatic humiliation.
Yeah. So I think that that's going to be a very complex environment that the South Korean president is going to have to deal with. The other thing that's distinct about this agreement is that they said that this was final and irreversible, meaning that both governments were committing that this issue would not be raised anymore officially between them. The Japanese government has always maintained that this was settled in 1965 during the normalization of the two countries' political relations, but still were willing to advance this additional agreement because of the outrage in South Korea over the issue. But I think it's going to be difficult for the South Korean government. They're going to have to deal with protests with regard to this issue, and we'll have to see how the general public reacts. There will be NGO groups that are motivated to be opposed, but we'll see what the public reaction is.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your taking the time to join us.
Sure. It's my pleasure, Barbara.
Victor Cha is Director of Asian Studies at Georgetown University, and thanks again for this. That'll do it for us for today. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Warren Olney, and join us tomorrow. I'll be here. To the Point is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.